Good evening, this is Mae Brussel. This is broadcast number 745. The program is titled World Watchers. The date is March the 17th, 1986. I suggest you tape this one-hour broadcast. I always suggest that. And if you want printed sheets of the sources of information, you can write to me, P.O. Box 22511, Carmel 93922, Carmel, California. And please send a self-addressed stamped envelope. And I suggest if you want the bibliography sheets for the month of February or the month of March, four sheets go into an envelope for 22 cents, and I can do it that way and send those to you at the end of the month. And you can collect them, put them in a three-hole notebook because I refer to back programs, and then it's easier to look them up. The Washington Times had an article that I just briefly mentioned last week, but I want to give you the source. It was February 26, 1986, about Willard Al Rockwell Jr., the chairman of Rockwell International, the former chairman, offering to replace the Challenger and putting it in the hands of private industry. It would involve the privatization pitch, which is taking place, not separate from what the Heritage Foundation wrote a memo about, turning over the space shuttle program to private people, identical to IG Farben, the pharmaceutical company that was making synthetic rubber, and about two thousand items for Adolf Hitler, to privatize the space. Now, Mr. Rockwell's money comes from the profits of the ships that we've already paid him and gone into debt for, his warfare weaponry. But he has offered to be the front man. He has a company called Astrotech. Now, Astrotech is 14% owned by Rockwell. It lost $5.9 million last year on a revenue of $122 million, and it had a hefty long debt of $80 million. So be careful. He's offering to put in $2 billion on the spaceship with those kind of debts last year. The Wall Street Journal, March the 5th, cites something or a couple of items along that line, even more sinister. It's titled, Buy a New Shuttle, Our Five-Man Firm Will Get Right on It. And it refers to Mr. Rockwell at proposing to raise the $1.5 billion or $2 billion for the shuttle. And then the Daniel R. Sanford from Dallas, Texas, a small firm called Captronics Manufacturing. He won't tell how he raises the money. We're a private company, and that's private. Now, that could be money from IG Farben. It could be from Roman Haas. It could be from any private front organization that did business with Hitler, that is continuing the Fourth Reich, that could do operations on the shuttle that would be accountable to nobody. The Wall Street Journal goes on, even more secretive about plans for the shuttle is a fourth candidate called Romulus, R-U-M-U-L-U-S, Michigan-based Batten Heads Company, Romulus Batten, B-A-T-T-E-N, Heads Incorporated. Among other things, it does defense engineering and design work. Its president, Cyril Batten, won't discuss its finances, its shuttle plans, its facilities, its employees, or anything else. We don't want to let the cat out of the bag. I think of the yacht that Aristotle Onassis had that left Monte Carlo, went back and forth to Argentina with all German crews. Nobody spoke English. If it's his business, I won't tell you where the money comes. We'll put it up. You can be very much scared about the way the program, the space program, could go or shift gears. And I think you can start to be frightened right now. The subject of politics will be coming up to the Challenger story over and over again. The San Francisco Chronicle had a quotation today. A former NASA budget analyst said yesterday, if the space agency managers had been more attuned to human risks rather than political pressures, they would have heeded the warning about the rocket booster problems. Now, what were the political pressures? Do they go beyond, of course, the White House and the item it had to launch tonight? What were the political pressures, knowing the ship would blow up? What comes next, and what kind of chances or orders did they take? And the word political, as I say, returns again. Another spokesman for Cape Canaveral, their center director, Richard Smith, is criticizing the presidential commission. He says key NASA officials will leave. The agency will be crippled. They were already leaving, and I'm adding up the numbers of people in the situations that took place before this was exposed, and he is questioning their right of the media to distort certain questions and the integrity of the agency and certain individuals. It's the same Richard Smith that I questioned the very first broadcast I did after the Challenger went down. That was broadcast number 739, where he had a press conference the very next day. He was asked about the icicles and so forth, and he said indications were that there was very little risk involved. And remember how shocked I was that there should be any risk involved, and he's very casual, there was very little, and now he's angry that people are looking into what the risk was that did take place, and the Challenger blew up. I'm not going to do much on the Contras. The president is pushing for 100 million. Robert Dornan says it's 170 million. The San Francisco Examiner, March 16th, has a huge front page story by Seth Rosenfield about arrests in the San Francisco Bay Area, one in particular that involved $100 million. 430 pounds of cocaine came in on Pier 96 in San Francisco. It involved two men, Mr. Zavala and Cabezas, and Mr. Zavala said that the money went to the Contras, that it was political money, really political money, for the reinstatement of democracy in Nicaragua. Now, democracy in Nicaragua with those drug dealers is like democracy in Cuba with Batista as president, prostitution, narcotics, and the mafia using it as their headquarters. The CIA is involved in this, and the case has been locked up. The papers have been locked up, and there is going to be a trial in Costa Rica for Mr. Pereira, and maybe he'll bring in some of the stories of the CIA and the involvement there if he isn't killed before that takes place. The LA Herald, rather, has a picture of a lot of property, LA property that Mr. Marcos and his wife Imelda own under the name of her sister and his former mistress. And there's a photograph of a whole group of houses in Beverly Hills. One is at 506 Walden Drive. My parents live right up the block on the 600 block of Walden Drive, so when I'm down there this week, I have to be down Beverly Hills. I'll walk down the street and take a picture of that. They also own four homes on Maple Drive, the first home I ever had after we were able and fortunate enough to get a home in Beverly Hills was on Maple Drive, a house right next door to one that the Marcoses own, and they have four houses on that street. The picture of their home is 336 South Maple Drive, the one next to the one we had, another at 353, and so forth. They have homes all over Beverly Hills and very close to where I lived. I guess they have good taste like I have. Who knows what? I don't have their money, but I have the same taste. Last week I talked about some very important interconnecting links that I have to do just one broadcast on again. The links of the Heritage Recommendation, the Heritage Foundation that is behind Ronald Reagan all the way in his administration, and the recommendation to privatize the space shuttle program and put their laboratories up there where they could work on such matters that affect the private sector, such as health and agriculture and so forth. Put it up, privatize it, and nobody needs to know what the private corporation is doing. Take the money then and put it into the Star Wars and also to the transmospheric airplane, the vehicle, which is part of the Star Wars, and Ronald Reagan, of course, is pushing that. And they, not only is the Heritage linked to some very dangerous institutions that could be associated with genocide from the past or possibly in the future, but in comes the Hoover Institute in the past month and a half, pushing right after Ronald Reagan's speech, 4 days later, a speech to the Congress, for their money to study the causes of AIDS coming out of the Hoover Institute, a very political organization, their concern for AIDS and pushing to isolate people and mark them with armbands and predicting 10 to 20 million deaths in a short while. Then add to that the NASA suggestion that from Houston, Texas, that they use the space orbits for genetic engineering, strengthening crops, understanding human disease. And you have a hunk of interest in the exact things that the Heritage Foundation would be concerned with: mass elimination of population and thereby not having too much poverty, and genocide. So NASA and the Hoover Institute and the Heritage Foundation have seem to have common interests. And then add the Hughes Medical Institute, another that is a example, perfect example of the secrecy where nobody can go in and find out what their doctors do, how much they're paid, what their research does. And they disperse money all over the United States to hospitals, and we have no record of the medical schools and hospitals or of what they're doing, because it's private and they're dispensing money in Houston that does link directly to a former astronaut, to the NASA program, to Mr. Robert Rich. I cited him last week, Henry Cuss, K-U-S-S, not Robert Rich, a former deputy assistant with the Defense Department who's dispensing this money, and there is a very dangerous situation here, which I cited in general, a few particular articles, and I'm going to go back to them before long and go chart out the institutions and the money that we know about, not certainly can't touch the ones that they're secretive about. I referred last week to covert action and some quotations in their last issue, number 25, regarding the Nazis in Greece, and that same issue has it's a whole part on the Nazis and their role with the OSS and the Waffen-SS and Allen Dulles and the CIA just before the end of the war and after the war, and the melding of these organizations together. And there's one page in this issue, page 26, Nazi Doctors in Demand, and it tells about Project Paperclip and the medical staff in Frankfurt, Germany, September 1951, after 28 months with Project Paperclip, medical staff in Frankfurt, Germany, Major General Walter Emil Schreiber was brought to the United States for a six-month stint at the Air Force School of Aviation Medicine in Texas. Its Nazi chief of medical science, Dr. Schreiber, was directly responsible for ghoulish experiments the Nazis conducted on inmates, and massive evidence revealed at the time of the Nuremberg trials some of the experiments, which included injecting humans with typhus and virus and producing live vaccine, injecting others with infectious epidemic, jaundice, sterilizing by surgery, X-ray, and drugs, submerging victims in tanks of ice water to measure shock levels, locking prisoners in low-pressure chambers to simulate flight altitudes of up to 68,000 feet, which result in the collapse of the lungs, and exposing subjects to heavy doses of incendiary phosphorus materials. Now, when I read the list of things that the Air Force wanted to use of Dr. Schreiber, they could also be applicable to the people in the space shuttle that are being examined very secretively with autopsies, because the bodies were preserved in the cold weather. Then they could take them secretly and check up some of these very identical experiments that were done earlier that are much more sophisticated now. And Dr. Schreiber worked for Project Paperclip, which involved the Nazi rocket scientists. And I'll do more about him also, but I think it's important to know that the use of these Nazis was important for the United States, and they were brought to this country, again, through Project Paperclip, and Mr. Schreiber was taken to Argentina in May 22, 1952, and of course Joseph Mengele went down there with his medical records, and so also the United States joined forces, according to covert action, with Major General Kurt Blohm, B-L-O-M-E. Some of the Nuremberg charges against them were wholesale practice of euthanasia, injecting intravenous undiluted lethal phenol, execution of tubercular prisoners, use of biological warfare. His specialty was brought to the United States, and they used it in July 1945 for interrogations. He conducted experiments on victims with plague vaccines, and he worked with Heinrich Himmler. Blohm was acquitted by the Nuremberg Tribunal, even though the prosecutors gathered a great deal of evidence against his activities. And 2 months after his acquittal, he was contacted by four employees of the Army Chemical Corps at Fort Detrick for a discussion about biological warfare. And Fort Detrick is the location that I have cited for the plans to make a disease that could be translated to be AIDS that would not respond to various treatments, would break down the immune system. Blohm cooperated. He worked. He volunteered the names of other German biological warfare specialists, and in August of 51, he signed a Project 63 contract as a camp doctor at the U.S. Army Occupation Force European Command Intelligence Center at Oberursel. A frequent Defense Department contractual document showed entry under the head of his qualifications, Professor of Medicine with emphasis on research of tuberculosis and cancer and biological warfare. One of the lesser-known Nazi doctors, Mr. Strughold, Strughold, a Luftwaffe member, was reportedly knowledgeable about low-pressure chamber experiments on camp inmates, and they said it's not known whether he came to the United States as part of the Paperclip Project. In 1963, he did work for the Air Force for many years. He's still living. Today, he's at Brooks Air Force Institute near San Antonio, Texas. It is the Herberta Strughold Aeromedical Library, named after him, the father of aerospace medicine. So if you think that my ideas about the outrageous implications of the Heritage Institute, of Hughes Medical Institute, of the privatization of Rockwell, of these other firms that won't tell you what they, where they're getting their money, you can worry a great deal about what is going on with the space situation and also with diseases on planet Earth, and how much are they going to be used to wipe out the population. I'm sure if you are reading the newspapers, you're seeing all of the warnings of impending catastrophe that would happen on the shuttle program. The New York Times had a story, 1983 report on shuttle, warning of catastrophe, and I've cited that before. And they mentioned the danger that it would have because the next probe would contain plutonium and a high dangerous element if it explodes and particles are inhaled. This was also reprinted in the Los Angeles Herald, February 1st, 1986. And it tells about interviews with NASA officials and the dangers of flying with these conditions that they knew about. And a 92-page report dated December 1983 by R.K. Weatherwax, president of Sierra Energy and Risk Assessment, a subcontractor to the Air Force Weapons Laboratory in New Mexico. The report was ordered distributed only to government agencies, not to the public, but the report was made available to the New York Times by the House Subcommittee on Energy Conservation and Power. The chairman of the subcommittee, Edward J. Markey, a Massachusetts Democrat, said he was particularly interested in the report because it addressed potential accidents involving radiation from two shuttle missions that were planned for later this year because of the particles exploding if it was inhaled. Markey said his interest also was stimulated by a February 5th article in the New York Times that NASA didn't use the most rigorous analysis available to mitigate potential accidents, and because of the internal study, if accurate, it indicated that a number of planned shuttle launches could assure the catastrophe a virtual certainty. But the important thing besides the certainty is the fact that the next launch would have the plutonium on it. And I briefly mentioned that last week. And when I wrote for The Realist, Paul Krasner, 1974, the SLA is the CIA, I felt that after that incident that was manipulated, and that was the COINTEL program, the Operation Chaos, of Ronald Reagan and Edwin Meese, that the final way to scare this country would be to have fictitious liberation armies organized to plan acts of violence that would include chemical warfare, and that would bring the Federal Emergency Management Agency into operation. And I could see this being used on us as an excuse to take control. On March 1st, 1986, and I just cited this briefly last week, Challenger death may avert nuclear disaster, Jesse Jackson says. And in this particular article from the Houston Post, he tells about the launches that are now being postponed, the two that were to take place, and that the two involved radioactive plutonium, which is the most toxic substance known to scientists, and concerns launching shuttles carrying it aboard their cargo. And this should have been raised before this January 28th shuttle explosion, but it came out now. It was secretive until then. And Jesse Moore, the new head of the Space Agency, the one who gave the green light on launching on January 28th, said it's too early to judge if launching the plutonium-powered probes is too risky. It's too early to judge. That's a topic that's going to get a lot of attention, he said. And the question was, how much risk is there involved in this particular space shuttle program when they are so careless the way one exploded and obviously probably knew it was going to happen? But what about the next two if this one had actually survived the cold weather? Jesse Jackson said maybe the seven who died would save 4 billion. I suppose he means the world population, and there are terrible dangers involved in taking plutonium up there, seeing the casual way in which these people handle this material, or was it casual? The real deep question is, was the Federal Emergency Management Agency just there waiting for an accident to happen, and could it happen in this particular area? February the 6th, 1986, Los Angeles Times has a story, nuclear cargo seen risky for shuttle flights. The fiery explosion that ripped the Challenger raises questions about the vulnerability of nuclear cargoes intended in the future flights. The next mission after the ill-fated Challenger would carry the nuclear-powered Ulysses solar probe satellite into orbit. The scientists say radioactive plutonium particles scattered at smoke or dust debris would pose a serious public health hazard to anyone who inhaled the cancer-causing residue. A cloud of plutonium particles released in the sky over Canaveral could turn parts of Florida into an area that's uninhabitable, said Dr. John Goffman, a professor of medical physics at UC Berkeley. The Energy Department contends that the protective shell around plutonium would withstand the explosive pressures, but however, a NASA safety analysis said that a wide range of possible shuttle accidents could generate greater force. And we're wondering, what is that green box that they're looking for? And already they've spent about $25 million on the search. And I'm wondering what there is down there that they've already spent approximately $25 million or more. And there was warning about a green box. And I wonder if there was plutonium on this particular Challenger. The article goes on to say Diane Butler, an Energy Department spokesman, said Wednesday, it appears the Challenger's explosion would not have been sufficient to create a deadly plutonium cloud. The nuclear generators are wrapped in iridium, I'll get it right, and then encapsulated in graphite shell that would protect it. NASA administrators declined comment on the force of the blast, but their safety analysis check showed that by activating the spacecraft's command destruct mechanisms, explosive devices attached to the large external tank and suspected of being detonated would produce a burst of pressure ranging from 740 psi to 7,800. Now, the article goes on, in a draft environmental impact for Project Galileo, NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory talked about the risk of plutonium dispersal. It would be small due to the high reliability inherent in the design, and this is what they told the high reliability of the booster going off before, and they felt that the chances of injury from plutonium were not too great during this period. But Mr. Goffman in UC Berkeley was not reassured. What happened last week didn't happen the way they said it would. I don't honestly know if plutonium could be dispersed by such an explosion, but for something as hazardous as plutonium, I'd want more assurance of safety. And they referred to the Galileo and Ulysses, which would go up next, which wouldn't be the first nuclear-equipped satellites launched by the United States. NASA has 22 payloads, including some aboard the manned Apollo lunar probes and various satellites that incorporate plutonium fuel generators. These launches resulted in aborts in 1964. They had navigational problems, and they burned up on reentry. And according to Goffman, traces of plutonium were scattered around the globe, leaving trivial amounts in virtually all living things. In 1968, a meteorological satellite was destroyed, and part of it was recovered and found from the ocean intact, according to NASA. And in 1970, the Apollo 13 mission curtailed an explosion in flight, jettisoned its plutonium generator prior to reentry. It's deposited in the South Pacific's Tonga Trench, where, according to NASA, it is effectively isolated from man's environment. So that they have had problems, and plutonium is around in the environment, and there's been a warning that the 50 pounds of plutonium that they were going to put on the next spaceship is astronomical. It poses an environmental threat only if it's inhaled, according to NASA scientists. If it comes back to Earth the size of marbles, there's no problem, but you can kiss off any area that gets dusted. That's pretty casual, to kiss off any area. Dr. Kendall, chairman of Union of Concerned Scientists in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is concerned. He shares Mr. Goffman's concern about plutonium danger, He says if it just fell in a big chunk, it could be retrieved. It might upset people, but it would not in any sense produce a holocaust. But there are risks if it should break, and it would require presidential approval if it had to be obtained and before the nuclear cargo could be launched aboard the shuttle Atlantis. And the pieces of it, as I say, would be scattered around the globe. If it fell in hunks, you could pick it up. If it scattered, it would be very dangerous. And maybe, as I say, that's why they're looking for that little box in Florida to see if there was anything on there or not. We don't know, but they're very secretive, and some of the scientists are warning that it could be dangerous. Now, to get back to plutonium and the rocket scientists and an area which is seems a little bit fringe or offy, but I want to mention it because I think it's pertinent to the dangers of people handling this material and what they do with this material and who are those who have it, how safe is it, and just loading it, whether it falls in dust or chunks, is a matter of argument, I guess, between the scientists, the differences in danger. But there are a lot of people who are getting their hands on the plutonium besides those very people who promise to be so exact. Remember the Getz story that was in the news for a long time and has been out of the news for a long time? Mr. Getz, the son of immigrants from Germany who lived in New York City, Bernard Getz, who shot four people on the subway and left one of them paralyzed. Time magazine, January the 14th, has an article about Bernard Getz, end of the line. And the reason I'm bringing Bernard Getz up is that there were threats to put plutonium, the very material that is so dangerous, it's going up in the next two shuttle programs or was scheduled to go. There are threats to put plutonium in the water of New York and poison the people in New York if Mr. Bernard Getz wasn't let off and wasn't prosecuted. And going back to Time magazine, January the 14th, called End of the Line, the Subway Shooter Surrenders, visitors to Warner, New Hampshire, often stop by Hillside Books, an antique bookstore, to sit by the fire and chat with owner Thomas Stotler. A day or two after Christmas, a mild-mannered traveler dropped in. He said he was from New York, wanted to get away from the city. He told Stotler he had been mugged five times, stalked at length, had little protection from New York criminals. The book dealer asked his guest if he had heard about the fugitive vigilante who had shot four youths in New York City, and he said yes. How did you hear about it? The visitor asked. He was interested in it, said Stotler. He didn't try to pin me down for details, and after a while, he left without purchasing a book. I thought he was a nice guy, and after hearing what he did, I still do. And after a few days after visiting the bookstore, Bernard Getz, 37, ended his 9 days flight from justice, and he had driven a car to New Hampshire in a rented car, went to the bookstore, and then went back and turned himself in. And as I say, he is the son of immigrants from Germany living in New York City, and he has a company, he calls it, it's supposed to be his own company, Electronics Calibrations Laboratory in Greenwich Village, which he has been running this company for quite a while and lived in a particular apartment there since 1976. Now, the Daily World had an article August 2nd, 1985, calls a bomb humanitarian, and the article is about the same Tom Stotler who Bernard Getz went all the way up to New Hampshire to visit. And incidentally, the reason I'm bringing this up is it's the same town in New Hampshire where Christa McAuliffe came from, and a man who was doing press coverage for her for months was referring to Bernard Getz being up in New Hampshire. And I'm thinking of plutonium and NASA and the operations whereby certain people can have access to plutonium and threaten a city like New York or threaten the whole United States, similar to what I put in The Realist in 1974. That's why I'm bringing this up now. Call a bomb humanitarian. The article goes on. An ultra-right group called Freedom Through Strength plans to use a full-page ad in the Washington newspaper to advertise and emphasize what it calls the humanitarian aspect of bombing Hiroshima. The paid message in the Washington Times. Now, that's the paper run by Reverend Moon, and the editor is Arnaud de Borchgrave, and this is the nest of the counterintelligence, covert action, spy teams of the far, far right. The paid message in Washington Times, the ultra-right publication owned by the Unification Church, is to coincide with peace demonstrations around the world calling for an end to the nuclear arms race. Freedom Through Strength advocates a massive military buildup at the expense of people's social needs. It has been recruiting mercenaries to fight in Central America. Tom Stoller is a member of Freedom Thought Through Strength. He owns the New Hampshire bookstore where New York City subway gunman Bernard Goetz went last December after he shot four black teenagers. Goetz met with Stoller. Freedom Through Strength developed out of the Liberty Lobby, an anti-labor, racist, and anti-Semitic organization similar to the Klan, which operated in the 50s and 60s. The Reverend Jerry Falwell and people close to the Reagan administration are connected to the Liberty Lobby. We'll take a one-minute break and go back to Bernard Goetz and Mr. Stotler, the Washington Times, Liberty Lobby, and the space program, Plutonium. And is there any connection there are between a lot of these people, but how far-reaching will the plutonium go into our cities?